The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
It's from the Dhammapada. Through the round of many births, I've roamed without reward, without rest, seeking the house builder. Painful is his birth again and again. House builder, you are seen. You will not build this house again. All your rafters broken, the ridgepole dismantled, immersed in dismantling, the mind has gone to the end of craving. And in the fascicle, on arousing the aspiration that we have not been studying, that I keep referring to, Dogen says, you abandon the household by realizing that your house is not a true house. You enter the mountain and practice Dharma. You will not build a house again. We've been studying the Paramitas all along ago, and as promised, I said that I would draw from the wisdom chapter, Prajna Paramita, during these talks, and I did his last session as well, I think. So Prajna Paramita is the mother of all Buddhas. On our altar, she sits on the right hand of the Buddha. She's the wisdom that sees the non-duality of all things. That things have an appearance, but they are not their appearance. That a child is born, but no person comes into being. A person passes from this life, and a person has not ended their life. We chant the Heart Sutra each training day, the sutra of the Prajnaparamita teachings. You will not build a house again. The Buddha said, I roamed without reward, without rest, seeking the house builder. Painful is birth again and again. The mind has gone to the end of craving. It's craving that is the deluded aspect of desire. It's the attachment when we have desires. You know, I was listening to a talk recently. The teacher was saying that in English, you know, it is very specific. And so when we use the word desire, that can mean the desire for an ice cream cone, the desire to become a doctor, the desire to have a baby, the desire to alleviate suffering, to realize Prajnaparamita, the same word. And so in a way, it's a kind of poverty of meaning, because it can mean anything. And then in Buddhism, desire, when we vow to put an end to desires, it's the craving for desires. It's the unwholesome desires. It's the desires that are not helping. Or it's desires that are good, but then when we cling to them, then they become unhelpful. That's what we're striving to free ourselves of. Not all desires, bodhicitta's desire. To stay on that cushion when you'd rather run out, that's a good desire. The desire to let go of clinging to preferences, all of the raising the great aspiration. We're not trying to put an end to those desires. So the Buddha is speaking about from life to life, year to year, day to day, moment to moment, painful. But Buddhism also acknowledges, and the Buddha acknowledges, that it's not all pain, right? It's not all without happiness, without joy, without patience, without generosity, right? Truly bereft would a life be. We might say barely a human life that would be completely bereft of any of those qualities. We have, hopefully, in our life, moments, periods, experiences of happiness and joy and well-being and satisfaction, fulfillment. And, the Buddha said, they are impermanent. And because they're good, because they're nourishing, because they feel good, they're good signs that when they change, that's what we tend to have trouble with. And so, in the measurables, to chant that to know the root of happiness, the root of the cause of our suffering, the root of equanimity. Dogen said, with discerning mind, the aspiration for enlightenment, without discerning mind, the aspiration for enlightenment cannot be aroused. It's not that discerning mind is the aspiration for enlightenment, but that the aspiration for enlightenment is aroused with discerning mind. And so this is the mind, we've talked about this, is the mind that reflects, that is aware, that examines. We wouldn't be here without that discerning mind. We would not have been in our lives and noticed what's going on and begin to wonder or ask questions or reflect on the distance between what we're experiencing and some inner sense of what might be possible. And then to have reflected on that enough that we didn't just discard it, we didn't ignore it, we stopped just trying to satisfy that in any, you know, of the easily accessible but always unsuccessful ways, more stuff, more things, more something. We reflected on it enough, discerned it enough to seek. And so there is active discernment. The teachings encourage that. In the Zen tradition, it's, in the early tradition, Theravada tradition, Tibetan Buddhist, it's much more explicit. It's much more sort of didactic. It's taught how to discern things that we need to examine. In the Zen tradition, the koans is one way that discernment is taken up. And there's discernment where we're just reflecting, we're thinking about things. And then there's a discernment that begins there, but then goes beyond just thinking, just thought, and words. In Shantideva's wisdom chapter, he says, in examining the nature of the self, so the chapter on prajna, gaining understanding about the nature of the self, Shantideva says, neither the feet nor the calves are the body. And so here he's talking about how we identify with the body. I must be my body, right? That's how I identify you. That's how I know you are you. That's how I can call you by your right name. That's how I can have a sense of knowing you to the extent that I might. Because I identify you with your body, among other things. And so Shantideva takes that up. And this is a practice that goes back to the Buddha. Look at the Satipatthana Sutta. So he says, neither the feet nor the calves are the body, nor the thighs or the loins, neither the front nor the back of the abdomen is the body, nor the chest or the shoulders. Neither the sides nor the hands are the body, not the arms or the armpits. None of the inner organs is the body, nor is the head or the neck. So where is the body to be found? So it's taking up this sort of, you know, long-carried assumption that we might not even think of. In fact, generally, who thinks, I identify myself with my body? We just do it. We don't necessarily think about it. It's largely unexamined, unquestioned. It seems inarguable. But here it is questioned. Because that's what Buddhism does. That's what the Buddha did. That's what he taught. And so if I identify with the body, if the body is me, then where? Which part of the body? So Shantideva, in this traditional way, basically looks at all these different parts. Am I my hands? Am I my calves? Am I my thighs? Am I my front, my back? He says, if you say that the body is distributed among all of its parts, it's just sort of spread out throughout all the body, then where does a separate possessor of those parts abide? Then where is myself? And so the examination by dissection, right? We've talked about this during the Ago, traditionally a chariot. I think I use that example of a bicycle. You could take anything and take it apart and lay it out. So now it's all the parts, but you wouldn't say with all the parts on the floor, whether it's your body or a bicycle, you wouldn't walk up and say, that's a bicycle. I might say, well, those are the parts of a bicycle. But it's not a bicycle, because a bicycle refers to something that has its own independent existence. He says, and if you say that the entire body exists within each part, such as the hand, myself is in each of those parts, and then somehow sort of permeates all of them through all of the parts, he says, then it follows that there are as many bodies as there are different parts. There are as many selves. So my hand has a hand self, a hand identity. But if that's true, then why, when I stub my toe, does my hand go down and hold it and give it comfort? Right? It's independent. It shouldn't really matter. It shouldn't, you know, foot's on its own. Sorry, see what's happening down there, but, you know, like, I got things to do up here. And then he goes on to take up feelings. Because in addition to identifying with my body, well, certainly my feelings, right? And we can err on the side of not regarding them well enough, right? Suppressing, denying, avoiding, not important, not the right ones. But we can also go to the other side and hold them too tightly, make them too prominent, make them too me. And so he says, if painful feelings were truly existent, just as an example, then they could never change. Because if they existed in and of themselves, then that means they aren't affected, they don't change. Because change means to be under, within the conditions in which something within it will be affected by something that is not it. And so if painful feelings are truly existent, Shantideva says, they could never change. And then it follows that living beings could never experience pleasant feelings. Because we'd always be experiencing painful feelings because they're permanent. And you could do whatever you wanted. You could do sesshin for 10 years. And you would not be able to affect those painful feelings because they would have their own independent existence. But of course, that's not what we see. Well, certainly then my mind must be myself. Shantideva says, mental consciousness, mind, cannot be found in the six senses in the objects the senses perceive. It can't be found either inside or outside the body, and you can't find it anywhere else, right? We don't have a lost and found for minds, although many minds are lost. It might be good if we could gather them all together, right? It is not the body, nor its other. The mind isn't in the body, but it's not apart from the body. It is not the slightest bit self-existing. And this lack of self-existence, existing by itself, Nagarjuna said, is emptiness, the emptiness of the mind. And this, Shantideva said, is called the natural state of nirvana, when we realize that. Prajnaparamita. And just to be meticulous, what about our karma? Well, certainly our karma, our self is in our karma and our actions. But Shantideva said, because we acknowledge that the continuum of a person who commits an action is not different from the continuum of the person who experiences an effect. So when I do something, create some karmic action, intentional action, and then I experience the consequences of that, we acknowledge that there's a continuity, right? Otherwise, no one would be responsible for anything. And we would not feel the consequences of our actions, neither positive or negatively, because we would not be that person. And so, of course, there's continuity. And he said, goes on to say, but then at the time of experiencing the effect, the person who committed the causal action no longer exists. So when I experience the effect, if there were two different selves, right, then I would have nothing to do with the person who caused it. And at the time of committing the causal action, it would be impossible to see the person, it is impossible to see the person experiencing the effect. Both the committer of the action and the experiencer of its effects are merely imputed upon a single continuum of a collection of aggregates. In my case, I and you, because we're participating in this together, call this shugan. And what he's saying is that when I look back at the person who committed this action that I'm now experiencing the consequences of, what I'm doing is I'm imputing upon a continuum, there is continuity, but I'm imputing upon it a sense of self, me. Neither the mind of the past nor the mind of the future is a self, because the former has ceased and the latter has yet to be produced. So what are I? What am I? What is the self? Is that even the right question? And so, of course, these are questions, conceptual questions, but remember what Dogen says, without discerning mind, the aspiration for enlightenment cannot be aroused. And he's talking about the aspiration for enlightenment. Well, Buddhism teaches that without discerning mind, we can't really reflect on and sort of engage and begin to understand and then put into practice the teachings. Even if we don't study, even if we don't understand any of this, or even try to understand any of this, and we just go in and we get beginning instruction in Zazen, that's all I need, because it's a direct point to the human mind, right? So I'm just going to get that instruction, then I'm going to sit, I'm not going to do anything else, I'm not going to listen to any teacher, I'm not going to listen to any teaching, I'm not going to know any concepts of Buddhism, I'm just going to do the instruction. I'm still relying on concepts. I'm relying on what I think, I just heard, what the instruction was. I'm applying that to a whole aggregate of ideas, me, to attain another concept, which I'll call enlightenment. And so the Buddha said, right view is a good place to start. Since we have a view, before we come into practice. We're going to just be further developing that view, even if we're not aware of it. Why not do that well? Mental consciousness is not inside or outside the body, nor can it be found anywhere else. When a student is sitting with Mu, it is not the body, it is not yourself, it is not your karma, it's not your aggregates, it's not your history and your memories. All of that that we call ourself, that's what we're letting go of. We're letting go of attaching to any of those things. Just like desire, those things arising themselves are not a problem. It's when we cling to them. And we do, and we have, and we are. So the koan is to continually be practicing, recognizing when we're building the house. And we are the house builder. And we just put down our tools. We put down our materials. And we just are Mu. So it is not the body, but it's not outside the body. Nobody has ever realized their self-nature over there. And so to be Mu is to go beyond, which means to cease creating a sense of identity with or apart from this body, feelings, mind, karma. And in order to do that, to free myself of identifying with, that means I have to, because identity is just a word. It's the fruit of my attachments, the culmination of my attachments. It's the attaching that is sort of the inner engine. And so there's discernment that comes through wakefulness, and in this sense, an unspoken, wordless inquiry. So with the koan, or really any sort of insight practice of meditation, it may begin with words. Koans are an example of that. But at some point it has to become wordless. In other words, we're no longer moving forward via words. Even if the koan that the person is sitting with is using words as the vehicle, there has to be a point at which they cease to be words. What does that mean? That we cease to impute an idea into something that we call a word. And it becomes something else, something alive. It becomes what it is. And because we are sentient beings, we feel, right? We put a lot of attention into thoughts. Thoughts, in a way, are the easiest part because they're much more object-like. They come and they go. And in a certain way, they sit on the surface. When they don't sit on the surface, it's because they're not just a mental object. They become something much more, or they've brought forth something much more, which is some sort of sensation, an emotion, some sort of experience in the body. Because we identify with the body as myself, when I experience that sensation, that emotion in the body, and I experience it, see it with my mind, and I can recognize it as an effect of my karma, the whole self is brought forward. And then just think of all of those aspects, which each in and of themselves I strongly identify. Even if I've never even thought about it. I am my body, I am my feelings, I am my mind. What is it that's so disconcerting? And naturally so, recognizably so, when there's someone that we love and they have Alzheimer's or dementia and they're losing their capacity, right? For their mind, the way we've always known, they've always known their mind to be accessible, to have that continuity, memories, shared experiences. And when that starts to slip away, that's disconcerting. And I've been with people who are you know, just living in a very real way right now something that happened 30 years ago, and watching a family member say, "No, Grandma, that didn't happen. That's not happening. That's not true. That's not real." Well, you bet your ass it is true for this person. It is true. But that sense of self that's being lost. And so what the teachings are saying is like, yes, everybody experiences that in different ways. To that degree, it might be cultural, to the way in which certain things are emphasized, certain cultures more than others. But in every culture, in every human being, there is a sense of self that arises. And there are ways in which that sense of self is connected to, identified with, based in certain aspects of who we are. That's the universality of human nature, human consciousness, in a sense of Buddha Dharma. But the Buddha said, the teachings say, but that isn't the self. Look, see, can you find it? Dogen said, arousing the aspiration for enlightenment is making a vow to bring all sentient beings to the shore of enlightenment before you bring yourself, and actualizing that vow. I would say if you bring all beings to the shore of enlightenment and you arrive at the same time, that's also good. Either way. Even a humble person who arouses his aspiration is already a guiding example to sentient beings. It's interesting. When somebody who may be in their confusion, in their own sense of feeling lost, in their sense of, you know, samsara, but is not defeated, has not become passive, but is actually raising a great aspiration, an intention. That's powerful. When we are lost and we see somebody else, or we feel cynical or skeptical, and we see somebody else who is committed to something, who is devoted to something, who is giving their energy to something good, they become a guiding example. Then she said, there's a true person of no rank moving in and out through the senses. Until it doesn't. And so that's why letting go means not grasping. And if we can't let go, right? Or if in not grasping, rather, let's say, the thing is still there, okay, so be it. If we identify myself as not this, a negative emotion, a harsh sort of, you know, bitter thought about somebody. No, I'm not that. I don't want to be that. That's a good thing. I don't want to be that. But this arising, why is that so painful? Why do we shirk from that? Why do we try and get rid of that? Distract ourselves from it, replace it with a better thought, sweep it under the rug, because I identify with it. If I didn't identify with it, it wouldn't have so much power. I was like, oh, that's harsh. But it's not me. But it is my responsibility. Because it's arising through this consciousness, this mind. It could be acted out through this body, this voice. None of which are mine. And so people came to the Buddha and said, well, if none of them are mine, why do you use the pronoun I? He said, because it's convenient. And it is, right? But to use it knowing that it's not me. But if we really think, you know, sort of reflect on it that way, then it makes sense why, when something comes up and it's so strong, it's not just because it's so bad or so gnarly. It's because I so strongly identify with it. That's what it's showing me. And in that way, it's showing me how strongly I grasp at that, even if it's something I don't want. And so if we can see it that way, I mean, the function of this reflection, this discernment, is to give us faith. To give us faith in the teachings. Like, how could there be no self? How could that be? How could a person without a self raise aspiration, make a vow, practice, return, start over, have faith, make commitments? It's so deep in us, that sense of self, that it's hard to even imagine how this could happen. And that very often when we are discerning the teachings, that sense of self just continually gets put back in. So we hear about the, you know, traditional teaching of rebirth. And I think, well, I don't know if I believe in that, but I could live again. I could come back. Right? I impute the sense of self. I'm here now. I get to come back again. Yeah, it's painful. You know, I have to go through puberty. I have to, like, you know, go to grade school again. I have to do all that shit. But, you know, finally I'll get to drive, move out of the house, do the good stuff. It's hard, it's so hard not to just keep imputing, just assuming there has to be a self in all of us. That is the continuum. The continuum is the self, and that's not what anyone who has looked has found. And so we raise the aspiration. The aspiration is raised. You know, I mean, and I've talked to people, usually young, very, you know, I'm going to the mountain. We had a guy years ago, many, many years ago, who called up from Arkansas. I'm going to say it was Arkansas. And he said, I'm selling everything, selling the farm, selling everything, throw it in the truck, I'm coming. I said, hold on. He said, no, I'm coming for enlightenment. I'm coming. I said, no, wait, click. And he shows up at the door. I was like, no, don't do that. So, coming to the mountain. Why did I bring that up? I don't know. That just went the way of all things. And so we raise aspiration. And that which has no body, no place, no self, no object, you can feel it. When you are motivated in anything, you can feel it. Right? And when you're not, you can feel that too. It's not like when the motivation goes away, you don't feel anything. We feel the lack of motivation. We call that apathy. We call it being in the desert. We call it a difficult time. And that's the wonder of motivation, of aspiration. As in anything, particularly anything good that is meaningful, that you really is important to you. Because if it's something that is important, it's probably going to take some time. Right? You don't have that kind of motivation to just, you know, go in and make spaghetti. That's different. This kind of motivation fills your body, right? And in a way, you need that because it's going to be a long path. And it could be anything, but it has to be important. And so that because it's a long path, you're going to get tired. Things are going to seem to distract you, right? It's going to be easy to wander away. Almost certainly you'll get discouraged at certain points, impatient. And so that motivation is that ground, that core that you keep coming back to. Why am I? Oh, yes. Right. You bring that back again. And in that way, it's like it's both the keel, the rudder, and the sail, and the wind. It's the whole thing. But there has to be a boat, right? You actually have to be in it and moving. Dogen says this aspiration is not in yourself, nor are you in it. And yet, it can be felt, it can be cultivated. That's what we do throughout the day. Listen to the liturgy. It's constantly, almost every time we do liturgy, I would say every time we do liturgy, whether it's Oriyoki, whether it's a service, whether it's evening gatho, whether it's caretaking, we're constantly bringing forth that motivation and dedicating that to everyone. Because when we're dedicating, when it's for everyone, then in those moments on that long path, when we are discouraged, we're tired, we're weary, we've made headway, and it would be easy to say, you know, this is pretty good. This is a whole lot better than back there. Maybe this is good enough. But then we think about and we see the limit of our limits and how they affect. Because they're still having an effect. And it's like, oh, no. I have to keep going. Shanti Davis said, for as long as they remain in samsara, may their temporary happiness never decline. Yes. When people are happy, even within samsara, even if it's temporary, they're happy. That's a good thing. When people are genuinely happy, they're much less likely to cause harm. When it's genuine happiness. And so Shanti Davis says, yes. Let's hear it for temporary happiness. But just know it's temporary. And may they all eventually experience the everlasting joy of Buddhahood. Don't be contented just with that. May the frightened be released from their fears. May those in captivity be freed. May the powerless be endowed with power. And may people think only of benefiting one another. It's like a drumbeat. May the frightened be released from their fears and think also of others. May those in captivity be freed and also be thinking of others. May the powerless be endowed with power. And yes, please be thinking of others as you assume power. Why do some people raise bodhicitta? Seek the path? Practice? What's important is those who do. When Dogen says, raising the great aspiration is not pervasive in the world, I think he's speaking to, it's not eternal, it's not something permanent, it's not something that exists in the world, and you just have to find out where it is and go get some. But I also think of it as, it's not pervasive, right? It's not that widely held. It's not in everyone's mind. Because what we can see and hear and taste and touch and smell and think, it's just there for the asking. You don't even have to ask for it. There it is. It's delivering. It's delivering without you even asking. It's giving us something. It's always giving us something. It's stirring our mind. It's stimulating our senses. It's feeding us. The world feeds us. Thank God. Thank you, world. But it's also, it's also filling, feeding, strengthening, giving rise to that not. Whereas the Dharma, that subtlety of bodhicitta, of being motivated, a feeling connected to the Dharma, of this part of your life, of this in your life, of this aspect of yourself, that's much more subtle. Much more subtle. It's not a thing. You know that it comes and goes, right? And when it goes, it's a little bit harder, right? That's why the what has come down, this structure, the discipline, the agreement. You know, how many times, and particularly in the early years, you know, did I hear that Han sound? And I think, I don't even know how I'm going to do this. I feel like shit. I'm tired. My mind's a mess. I'm not in a good mood. Stop the world. I'm not in a good mood. But it feels like that because it's all throughout. And I can't just drop it. But the Han was sounding. I had made an agreement. I come in. I take my seat. I think, I don't know how I'm going to do this. And then you know what? I do this. You do this. We see what is hard to see when we're standing on this side. When we have not walked to the door. When we have not lived into that aspiration. I came across a teaching recently. I want to end with this. It was very interesting to me. You know, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, there's a lot of about blessings, receiving the blessings from your teacher, from a lama, from the Dharma. And the Dalai Lama said, I want to explain what we mean by blessing when we talk about a teacher's blessing or the blessing of the Dharma in the Buddhist context. He said, blessing must come from within your own mind. So think of receiving a blessing. It comes from your own mind. It's not something that comes from outside. Even though we talk about a teacher's blessing or the blessing of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, when the positive qualities of your mind increase and the negative binding aspects decrease, that is what blessing means. That is a blessing. The Tibetan word for blessing means magnificent potential transformation. So transforming into magnificent potential. by strengthening all that is positive and by softening, weakening, letting drop away all that is not helpful. Therefore, blessing refers to the development of your virtuous qualities that you did not previously have or were incipient, and the improvement of those good qualities that you have already developed. It also means discernment. I added this. I changed. You don't do that to the Dalai Lama's teaching. All right, I'll go back. It also means, the reason I did that was because the word, I must have mistyped it. I don't know what the word means. It isn't a word. So I have to add in another word. Okay, respectfully. No, that's no joke. I forgot. That's actually what happened. So it also means discernment of the discernment of the defilement of the mind that obstructs the generation of our wholesome qualities, blessing. To be able to discern those qualities that are unwholesome and to be able to discern the positive qualities, right? So it's not just recognizing this is good and bad, but it's being able to have more understanding of them, to see into them more deeply. Dogen said, the ancient Buddha mind, the mind of Prajnaparamita, is not simply something that exists in the realm of emptiness. Prajnaparamita is non-dual. All things, all sides. Dogen says, it is being satisfied with every meal. It is being satisfied with grass and water. Investigating in this way and sitting as a Buddha, being a Buddha, this is arousing the aspiration for enlightenment. Being satisfied with each meal, being satisfied with grass and water, elemental things, simple things, with walking, with breathing, with standing, with lying down, being satisfied. With sunny days and cloudy days, bright energy and tired energy. I came across a book that Ojin Sensei made for me many years ago. It was a collection of these little pieces of paper that you had found in one of Dada Roshi's journals. And on each one, just a little piece of paper, was a handwritten little poem that he'd written. And this is all within like the first 2 or 3 years of being here. So it's a wonderful kind of window on what he was seeing and thinking about. Thank you for that. And one of them was, the forecast for today is dreary. The soft, luminous mist that covers the mountain, not dreary.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.